Hello. Good evening. And happy old year. It's old year still, but new year is coming soon. Now, according to the program which was suggested to me, that we'll start with a 10-minute guided meditation. Is that good?
Yes.
Really good?
Yes.
Really, really good?
Yes.
Nah. Okay, yes, we'll do the 10-minute guided meditation, and then afterwards we can do the talk. So those people who get nirvana enlightened during the meditation, you don't need to listen to the talk. So here we go, 10-minute guided meditation. So sitting here, bringing all your attention to this body, of closing your eyes. You are perfectly safe in this hall. So we bring our attention to our body. And just first of all to your legs. How are your legs positioned right now? Can you adjust them to make them more comfortable? By which I mean just moving the feet further out from the chair or tucking them underneath the chair, pulling the knees together or letting them go outwards. What makes your legs more comfortable? This is a combination of mindfulness and kindness. Being aware and being kind enough to your own body to adjust if needed. And then become aware of your buttocks, your bottom on the chair. If it needs to be moved, what we call fidgeting, please do it now. Until your bottom is as comfortable as possible. And then we become aware of our back. If you wish to follow me, I'm not stretching my back at this time. And after stretching it, I relax it. So my back feels so at ease. I've been aware and kind to my own back. And then I look at where my hands are put. You can put your hands in your lap, or on your knees, or wherever you feel they are comfortable. And you are allowed to move them this way, that way, until your hands are in the best possible position for you. This is mindfulness together with kindness, otherwise known as kindfulness. Then you go back up to your back and to your neck, making sure your head is well balanced on top of the neck. Not too far forward, not too far back. And if you have any irritation in your throat, it is allowed to cough during the meditation, to give your throat some ease and peace. And then you move up to your face, making sure the muscles around the eyes and the mouth are relaxed. Sometimes they are tense, and that shows in the muscles around our eyes and mouth. When we are aware of those muscles around the eyes and the mouth, we can on purpose relax them.
bring them to a state of peace. And once you've relaxed parts of your body one by one, then we observe, mindful, aware of our whole body, as if it's one thing, making sure from the toes to the tips of the head, and the hair of the head, everything is at peace, at ease, relaxed. When you do feel your body relaxed, it feels delightful. It's pleasurable. And there are some pleasures which are helpful for meditation. This is one thing. The pleasure of a relaxed body. So just stay there for a few more moments. The body nicely relaxed. Now we turn to our inner world, our emotional world, our mind. Now, how peaceful are you, or how agitated? There is something inside of you which I call the peaceometer. Like you have a thermometer to tell you how warm or cold the temperature is. Speedometer to show how fast your car is moving, is something we call the peaceometer. How peaceful are you right now? And give it a number from 1 to 10. 1 is really peaceful. 10 is really agitated. Now how do you move that reading of the peaceometer closer to one? What makes you more peaceful? And what makes you agitated? You are learning the secret of peace. Because this is only a short meditation, see if you can let go of all past, wherever you come from, wherever you are, whatever has happened to you that doesn't belong to the present moment. Just for this few moments, let it go. And as for the future, now is where your future is being made. And this moment is the only place, the only time you really have to make a good future. So if you are concerned about the future, be concerned about the present moment. And you'll find the reading of your peaceometer goes down. As peaceful as you can. And you do not need to think. You don't need to say any words. Just enjoy the peace in your own mind. So I do hope that you all enjoyed that deep meditation for just 10 minutes. Sometimes if anybody wants to try meditation at home or in the office, you are free to download any of these guided meditation instructions and just listen to them on your iPhones, with the earbuds. So it means that it's like having a teacher with you, guiding the meditation, any time, any place. And even if people listen to it on places like the toilet, I don't mind. At least it allows people to be peaceful, which is the main aim. Because sometimes you try to meditate by yourself, sometimes your mind can go all over the place. But if you have some guidance, it can be peaceful. And you can do that until the mind is trained enough to be able to meditate by itself without any guidance. In the same way, if you're learning how to drive a car, you need the driving instructor sitting next to you to make sure that you don't crash. And if after a while you pass your license, then you don't need the driving instructor anymore. So that's why the guided meditations can be very useful for you. Okay, so now I have a talk to give. And the talk this evening is on Nibbana. And for once, usually I don't get the opportunity to do this. I chose the topic this time. And you know the reason I chose the topic, Nibbana, was I thought that many of the Buddhist fellowship or the Bodhinyana, many of the people who usually come to my talks, are off in Thailand meditating with Ajahn Brahmali. So I thought, oh my goodness, there's a lot of people aren't going to be here. So I better get a really interesting, fascinating title to get people to come. And look, the hall is packed, which is wonderful. So anyway, Nibbana is supposed to be the goal of Buddhism. It's supposed to be where we're going to end up. But do you know what Nibbana means? Uh-oh, I have a note here. The mic is too soft. So you might actually just be closer to the mic. No, you've got a hard enough mic. Stop being so soft. Tough enough. It says the mic is too soft. Okay. So I don't think it's the mic's fault. I think it's me. After the meditation, I'm sorry for hitting you. Please don't go this. So if you can't hear at the back, please jump up and down and make some signs so I know that I need to get closer to the mic. So anyway, Nibbana, enlightenment. And that becomes part of my story of why I became a monk and how I became a monk. Because I was always interested in religious things. Always got this whistling. Look, I'm sorry, Michael. Please behave. So, when I was a student, I did really well in my studies. I went to a good school, a good high school, and there was a chaplain, a religious teacher in the high school. And I remember asking the religious teacher, God, what does that word really mean? I wasn't challenging anybody, I just wanted to know. And the chaplain, this religious teacher, he said, God is beyond words. It's ineffable. You can't judge it. Nobody really knows. It's beyond words. It's the Alpha and Omega of life. Yeah, but what is it? But it's beyond words. And I went out of that meeting. I was sincere. I wasn't trying to criticize anybody.
But I thought, that gentleman doesn't know what he's talking about. Because if you know what you're talking about, you can describe it. So then I went to Buddhist temples. And in Buddhist temples, I asked the monks, the senior monks, what is Nibbana? And they said, it's beyond words. It's ineffable. It's the upper limit of things. And I said, I've heard that before somewhere. You don't know either. So sometimes I find many Buddhists, they're practicing for Nibbana, and they haven't got a clue where they're practicing for, or where they're going. Imagine that you are a captain on Singapore Airlines, and you are taking off from Changi Airport, and you haven't got a clue where you were going to. Would that be acceptable? No, you go round in circles like many people do. So I wanted to really know what Nibbana is. So, what to do? I decided to go over to Thailand to become a Buddhist monk and find out for myself. Because all the people I asked, they couldn't give a straight answer. And it was also, I was fortunate. Because at that time I was 23 years of age. And I just finished a relationship with my girlfriend. Actually, she finished it with me. At the time I wasn't happy. But now I think, thank you so much for dumping me. That allowed me to go off to Thailand. I had a good degree, good education, I was fit, I was healthy, I was handsome. You don't believe me, do you? It is true, I get more photographs taken of me now than I ever did when I was young. But anyway, so I went off to Thailand with the intention of becoming a monk, and after becoming a monk, getting enlightened, and after getting enlightened, coming back to England, maybe 2 or 3 years, and then getting married. I actually thought like that. But when I went to Thailand to become a monk, the only reason why I went to Thailand to become a monk was I knew enough that Nibbana is supposed to be happiness. You're supposed to be peaceful and kind and joyful. So I went around looking at all these other monks and a few nuns from different traditions to check them out. So were they happy? Were they peaceful? No. So I'm not going to go to your country. So at that time, it was the Thai monks I knew seemed to be the happiest. You know, they used to call it the land of smiles. And in those days, it was a very peaceful, happy country. So I went to Thailand to become a monk. I never knew Ajahn Chah, I never knew where to go. I just landed in Bangkok and went to a monastery. Because this was recently that I was talking with the former Ajahn Chakra. He was the abbot when I first went to Australia. And he said that some people become monks to escape suffering. Some people become monks because they want more happiness. Different attitudes, but for me, he said, Ajahn Brahm always wanted more happiness. I already had a lot of happiness, but that's one of the reasons why people didn't think I was serious. Why go to hospital if you're not sick? So for me, I was happy, I wanted to get more healthy. So I went to Thailand to become a monk. And when I went to Thailand to become a monk, it was so hard to find good teachers. Eventually, it's amazing what happens in life. if it's almost meant to be, if your karma is good, good things happen to you. So I saw a couple of monks, and to me, they looked so dirty in their dark brown robes. You may have seen some monks in their bright orange robes, almost bright yellow. What's the difference? When I asked, I was told, well, if you wear bright yellow robes in Bangkok, you don't get hit by the traffic. There's a lot of logic to that. So I had my bright yellow robes, and I saw these monks in the dark brown robes. And I thought, you look so scruffy. But then I said, why do you wear dark brown robes? And they said, because that means you could spill tea and coffee on them, you don't have to wash your robes so often. There's a lot of truth to that. But no, this was the natural guys in the forest. So they invited me to come and stay with their teacher, who was called Ajahn Chah. So I just went up there for a week. And I went up there on, I think it's pretty accurate, December the 30th, 1974. Ooh! 45 years ago. And you think after 45 years you're allowed to retire. Can I retire? No. The older you are as a monk, the harder you have to work. And it's true. And even one of those monks, who's a good friend of mine, very well known, Ajahn Gangha, I thought that he would be my real friend. You know what he told me? I went to visit him to pay respect. If you don't know Ajahn Gangha, I have to tell a story about Ajahn Gangha and the snake. The snake? Yeah, the tiger, not the tiger, yeah, it was a king cobra. Ooh. He was meditating in the jungle with a few other monks. And as they were sitting down to meditate, they heard the sound of a jungle animal coming close. They opened their eyes, and the animal they saw coming towards them was a snake, a big snake, a king cobra. And in that part of Thailand, they used to call the king cobras the one-step snake. Why? Because if a king cobra bit you, you'd have one step and then you'd be dead. Ooh, that was a very venomous snake. So the king cobra slithered up to Ajahn Gangha, raised his head, opened his hood. Right in front of Ajahn Gangha's nose. Now, what would you do if you were Ajahn Gangha? And you had this big one-step snake, dangerous snake, right in front of your nose. Don't think of running. Because those snakes are faster than Usain Bolt. I've seen them. They slither so fast. I could not outrun them. Ajahn Gangha could not outrun them. So what did Ajahn Gangha do? He raised his hand and patted the king cobra on the head, saying in Thai, "Thank you for coming to visit me." Ooh, that was a true story. All the other monks saw that, and he patted the cobra on the head. Could you do that? No. That is the reason why the cobra loved every minute of getting a patting from a senior monk. Not often can you get a patting if you're a king cobra, so he's enjoying every minute. Oh yeah, just over there. And after 5 or 10 minutes, when the king cobra had his head patted enough by the head monk, he closed his hood, put his head down, and he called to one of the other monks. And the other monk said, no, go back. I'm not doing that, no way. But that was Ajahn Gandha, the monk, who came to stay some time in my monastery in Perth many years ago. So when I went to pay respect to him with lots of my disciples, he really let me down. He told everybody, he said, Ajahn Brahm, he's a very good teacher. If he stops traveling and giving talks all over the world, then he will die very quickly. That was so unfair. I was looking to retire, take it easy. I was born in 1951, so I'm over 68 now. Time to retire and let go. Can I? No. Because Ajahn Gandha said I'll die if I stop teaching. So anyway, off I went to Thailand to become a monk and start to learn about how to become enlightened. I get some idea of what it meant to become enlightened. I practiced and meditated. I realized it's not just 1 or 2 years. It's not just a theory, because I knew many theories. The theory of gravity, the theory of quantum physics, quantum mechanics. I knew so many theories. I thought I was so smart. And then I came across an Ajahn Chah who'd only gone to school 4 years. In primary school. And I went and got a big degree from Cambridge University in one of the hardest subjects. And who was smarter? You know, Ajahn Gandha. He was so much smarter than I was. I knew the theories, but he knew the practice. And that's what I learned, that it's not just reading books and getting great teachings from others. That was not what enlightenment was. It was something far deeper. So I had to stay for a long time. And I made a resolution, because people were asking me when I was in Malaysia recently, just actually yesterday, they were asking me, why? Why did I go to Perth? And I've been in Perth now for over 36 years. My 45 years as a monk, 9 years in Thailand, the last 45, last 36 in Australia, in Perth. Why did I go there? And the answer is because when I first decided to follow Ajahn Chah as my teacher, I made a resolution, a promise to myself. I would not ask to go anywhere. I would wait till my teacher sent me to a monastery to help out, and he would call me back. I would follow my teacher's recommendations on where I am to stay. It was a nice resolution. However, it did not work out as I expected, because he sent me to Perth in 1982. That'd be about right, 1983. And as soon as he sent me to Perth, a couple of weeks later, he had a stroke and he couldn't speak anymore. Which means he could not ask me to come back. And I've been stuck there for the last 36 years. And there's some truth in that, but I was happy where I was, so I make the most of what life gives to me. So that's why I ended up over in Perth. But before I even got to Perth, I really got into my practice of meditation. I was a very simple monk and lived very peacefully. I had few possessions, but one day, I think this was my 6th year as a monk, and it was the Mains Retreat. That's the time between July, the full moon of July, and the full moon of October, where the monks don't go anywhere except inside, meditating deeply to get their meditation so powerful, who knows, they may get an experience of nirvana. So I was at this monastery. It was very peaceful and simple. And I was meditating and meditating and meditating because there's nothing else to do. And as I was meditating more and more, my mind got brighter and brighter. It got happier and happier. More and more energy. And one night after the talk, I was not tired at all. I continued meditating and walking and meditating, and all these insights started to come. Powerful realizations of the truth of life. Powerful insights into the nature of the mind. They kept coming one after the other. Wow, amazing, tremendous. And then, the big one came. Ooh, the big one. Wow. How come I've never seen this before? This was so obvious. And I realized there was another enlightened being in this world. I don't know. Maybe the first English enlightened monk. It was so lovely being enlightened. It was so sad. It only lasted a few hours. That's really my case. I'm not allowed to stay if the person's in mind or not. But anyway, everything seemed to match what I'd read about. Beautiful energy. Great insights and understandings. 1 o'clock in the morning, not at all tired. 1:30 in the morning, full of energy. But I thought, well, everyone else is asleep. I better go and lay down. I lay down for half an hour. No way could you feel sleepy. No defilement, no mental problems at all. Your mind was perfectly peaceful. So I decided to go and do some more meditation in the hall. Meditating. No sleepiness. No thoughts. This perfectly poised mind. Oh, so wonderful being enlightened. I've already given the game away. I wrote about this. Unfortunately, it wasn't a real thing. It was close, but not a real thing. So, when the chanting started, we did the morning chanting. And it was as usual at 3:30 in the morning. Oh, everyone is so sleepy. And the chanting would be, this morning, full energy. Yo so bhagava alaham sammas. I was fully charged up. And after the minutes, after the chanting, meditate. So straight, so peaceful. No problem at all meditating. Not a thought in the mind. And then went on arms round. And when I went on arms round, All these poor villagers who gave a little spoon of rice into my bowl. I thought, you don't know how lucky you are. Being able to give rice to a newly minted enlightened being. Zap, zap, zap. I zapped them with energy and with merit. They were so fortunate. And when I got back to the monastery, wow, there was another really strange event. Usually in that monastery, we get our rice on our ground, and it'll be the same saucer of curry every day. It was called rotten fish curry, pramek, in Thai. And it was rotten fish. What they would do, they would catch the fish in the wet period, which was July to October, and they put it in earthen jars, just cover it with plastic, and let it ferment. Let it rot. It stank. But they thought that was delicious. It's okay to be born in that part of the world. I was born in a cultivated country. But anyway, you had to have that, you got used to it. But that morning, there were two pots. Had a long fish curry. And the other saucepan had a pork curry in it from the town. That was so rare. And I thought, wow. Wow. Even the heavenly beings have noticed that I'm enlightened and want to make some merit for me. And so I thought, wow, well done, heavenly beings. So, when we started to have the food, what happened? You have your rice as much as you like, but the two pots of curry. I was a number two monk in line. The head monk was a local boy. He grew up in that village. He should have got used to rotten fish curry. But did he take any rotten fish curry? No, not even a tiny tablespoon. He took the pork. One ladle, two ladles, three ladles. No one can eat that amount of that curry, even if you only eat one meal a day. That was a huge amount. But there was plenty there for me. So I wasn't upset until he took the remains of the pork curry. He lifted it up and poured it all into the saucepan of rotten fish curry and stirred it all up, saying, "It's all the same. It's all the same." What do you mean it's all the same? You took yours first and then you mixed it up. If it was really all the same, you'd have mixed it up first and then taken yours. That was just wrong. You are a hypocrite. You spoil my... And then it hit me. When you're enlightened, you don't get angry like that. Oh my goodness, I could not fool myself any longer. It wasn't enlightenment after all. And I'll tell you one thing, if you think you're enlightened and you find out you're not, that is a really severe form of depression. So afterwards, I didn't care what I ate, slop something in and passed it down. It was nice being enlightened for six hours or something. Shame it didn't last. But what it taught me, enlightenment, nirvana, is an experience you get from deep meditation. But sometimes you can fool yourself so easily. Just because you're happy, just because nothing bothers you, just because you can eat, anything, doesn't mean you're enlightened. Sometimes somebody says something and that upsets you. Just like that famous story of this young monk in China many years ago. He did his basic training And he went up to his teacher, the abbot of the monastery, saying, I've done all my basic training and service for many years now. Now I want to go for enlightenment, for nirvana. And said the monk, said, I found this little island. It's not far from this monastery. And it's abandoned. No one is there. Can you please give me permission to build a simple hut in the middle of that island? And having built a simple hut there, can I please just ask, can you send somebody over just once a week, with supplies for me? You know, with rice, but I don't just eat anything, just some beans, and just like have a little veggie garden there. And just once a week for any supplies, so I can meditate in perfect seclusion. And the abbot said, good idea. Off you go. So he built himself a simple hut in this tranquil island in the middle of a lake not far from the monastery. And every week an attendant would go over and take him any supplies he needed. If he needed anything extra, he would actually write it on a piece of paper and it would come next week. And for 3 years, he meditated in perfect solitude, only seeing a person once a week. And after 3 years, he decided he was enlightened. No imitations. No greed, hatred, or any delusion. So what to do now? So he thought to himself, once you're enlightened, you should share it with others. You should teach for the benefit and happiness of all other beings. So how can I actually do that? So he decided the next time the attendant rode over from the monastery, he wrote on a piece of paper, can I please have some parchment, an old quill pen, and some ink? He never said why. And then when it came the next week, he meditated, when his mind was clear and pure, he wrote down a poem in 4 lines. Obviously it was in Chinese, but the translation went, the diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the 4 worldly winds. Now in Buddhism, that was an expression of being fully enlightened. So he wrote it in beautiful calligraphy. And when it was dry, he rolled up the parchment, tied it in a little bow, and waited for the attendant to come. And he gave the parchment to the attendant. Give this to the abbot. 1 week later, he received something back from the attendant. He thought this must be an invitation to take over being abbot of this monastery. An invitation to teach. His abbot would surely realize that if it was right, this was true, he was fully enlightened, and so he thought he could leave the island now. But when he opened the parchment, the answer from the abbot, he realized that was his parchment. He unfurled it. And on the first line of this beautifully crafted calligraphy, the abbot had scrawled in a red pen the words F-A-R-T, fart. That was really impossible. He'd written fart over the first line of poetry. And the next line of poetry, first line, The diligent monk alone for three years was the second line. He wrote fart in capital letters, F-A-R-T, capital. The third line is no longer moved. F-A-R-T, with an exclamation mark afterwards. And the fourth line, by the four worldly winds, he'd written F-A-R-T in huge letters, three exclamation marks, and underlined. And this was something, a declaration of somebody's enlightenment, which should have been hung in some national gallery somewhere. And this stupid abbot had just scrawled graffiti on it. And so the monk, he ran to the shore, he saw the attendant in the boat, come back now. And the attendant came back, take me to see that stupid abbot. And so he took the monk over to see the abbot. The monk charged into the abbot's room with the calligraphy on the parchment, slammed it down and said, "What have you done to my declaration of enlightenment?" And the abbot took off his glasses, stood up, unfurled the piece of paper, and said, "So, young monk, the diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the four worldly winds, yet four little fogs have blown you clean across the lake." And so the monk realized he was not enlightened and had to go all back over to the island in the lake to carry on meditating. So that's actually what happens. Sometimes people think they've attained nirvana. Sometimes they come up to me to say that. And I look at them and say, maybe it's like a girl from Singapore. And I say, "I'm sorry, but Singapore women can't get enlightened." And I would wait to see their face. And then they say, What are you talking about? That's sexist, that's misogynist, that is racist." If that's what they say, I say, "Well, you're not enlightened." But if they say, "Oh yeah, well, fair enough," I say, "Hang on, maybe you are." Because an enlightened being, someone who's experienced nirvana, does not get angry and upset. And even in the time of the Buddha, I remember one of the great sutras, teachings of the Buddha, where this Ananda, the Buddha's chief attendant, was with the Buddha, and this monk came up and said to the Buddha, "One who is fully enlightened, an arahat, who's seen nirvana, never thinks that they are better than anybody else. They never think they're worse than anybody else. And they never think they're the same as anybody else. Not better, not worse, not the same." And the Buddha said, "Yes, correct, well done, yes, that's true." And then a second monk came and said exactly the same thing. "The one who is enlightened, fully enlightened, arahat, never thinks they're better, never thinks they're worse, never thinks they're the same as anybody else." "Correct," said the Buddha. And when that second monk had departed, the Buddha turned around to Ananda and said, "Those were two new arahats, two beings who just very recently, this very day, had become fully enlightened, fully enlightened." And that's how they tell me. The enlightened being is not better, nor worse, nor the same as anybody else. Their sense of self and ego has been let go of a long time. And that was so important for someone like me and for you to consider, because often people are trying so hard
to achieve nirvana. And all they do is to get tense and disappointed. And to understand what I mean, I was in Sri Lanka many years ago as a monk, already becoming quite well known because of the talks which I give, which actually people wake up to. You know, sometimes people go to a talk in a Buddhist temple and the monks start teaching about the Four Noble Truths and their head goes down. It's not interesting. It doesn't enliven people. It doesn't reach people. That's one of the reasons why. You know, I try my very best to make it interesting. So, sometimes the people go to the temples and they listen to talks on Nibbana and they don't understand a word of it. But I realized from Master Khatam Chao, you have to have some experiences. So I did a lot of meditation. I taught meditation. I wrote meditation books. But all of that, and on live TV, it was one of the monks who interviewed me, and they gave me one of these questions, which really puts me on the spot. Ajahn Brahm, he asked, "You have written many books on meditation. You have written many books describing deep meditation, the jhanas. These are deep meditations. Now, Ajahn Brahm, you're on camera. Can you achieve those jhanas you write about? Can you enter jhana, Ajahn Brahm?" And I thought, oh my goodness, that's a difficult question. Because as a monk, it's one of my rules. It's the eighth rule in the Paticca section. A monk is not allowed to tell people other than other monks whether they have any disattainments or not. It's a Paticca rule. And I keep my rules. I'm a good monk. But if I say I can't get these things, then people will think, oh, you're just a fake. You're a fake monk. You teach other people to do things you can't even do yourself. That's always been difficult, but you may know I've got a good brain. So I found loophole. I like using loopholes. So on camera, in front of a big audience, being interviewed by a monk, I looked him straight in the eye and I said, "Ajahn Brahm cannot enter jhana. I can't do it." And straight away, some of those people felt fake, fraud, and they were going for the doors to leave. And then I told them, to get a jhana, Ajahn Brahm has to disappear. If I'm still doing something, jhanas are a long way away. And then I told them what they all knew, just to make sure that they knew that this was something they should have understood. From the Visuddhimagga, this great text of meditation instructions, written a long time after the Buddha passed away, but there's many wonderful sayings in there. And one of them is, enlightenment is, but not the person who enters it. The path is, but no traveler on it is seen. Wow. I always loved that phrase. The path is, but no one who does the path, who walks the path, no traveler upon it is seen. And that is precisely what you do when you're meditating. You vanish. You disappear. when Ajahn Brahm vanishes and he's not there anymore, the path is so wide. And that's where all the experience comes from. That's what happens so often. Okay, this is deep. I said the funny stuff already. When you really get deep in meditation, you have to let go. To let go, you have to vanish, you have to disappear. There's no person who bears your name anymore. You are so still and peaceful. Everything which defines you disappears. You're not a man, you're not a woman, you're not a monk or a nun. You're not old, you're not young, you're not a Buddhist, a Muslim, a Christian, or a Hindu, or whatever. You vanish. The body goes. That is so wonderful, because sometimes the people are old or sick. They think, I'm just too old or sick to meditate and get enlightened. No, you're not. Only your body is old and sick. And of course, I know that from when I disappeared years ago, I had scrub typhus. The same symptoms as typhoid. My first or second year in Thailand, I cannot remember exactly now. But when you have scrub typhus, you have really bad fevers, really weak, and because nobody knew exactly what it was, they gave me all sorts of cocktails of drugs injected in my backside in the morning and afternoon by one of these Thai nurses. You may think Thai nurses are very petite and very gentle. Not this nurse. She was built like a water buffalo. She was so tough. When she didn't inject you, she stabbed you. And honestly, my backside was so sore after only about 3 or 4 days of this, and it lasted a couple of weeks. And every time I did my chanting, which is a young man has to do, may all beings be happy, but not that nurse.
Oh.
And Ajahn Chah came to see me. My teacher, you know what Ajahn Chah said to me? That was the time he said to me, Brahma Wangso, that's the full name, Brahma Wangso, you're either going to get better, if you don't get better, you'll die. And then he left. He had no bedside manner at all. I was looking for a bit of a lift. How are you? Anything I can do? No, you should talk me to down. Bang, bang, bang. So he did. Yeah. Very good. See, people actually learn. But anyway, so then I was really exhausted, didn't know what the disease was, weaker and weaker, felt terrible, backside really sore, 2 stones across my legs and sit on it, my backside that is. So I just one day decided, okay, let's meditate, why not? You don't have to meditate sitting cross-legged in full lotus on broken glass. I was lying in the bed in the month's ward in Ubon Hospital, and decided just to let go deep in meditation. Beautiful experience. But in the deep meditation, there's no sick monk anymore. There's no monk, you just go inside your mind. And the body totally vanishes. It's great when the body vanishes, because you can't hear anything, you can't see, you can't smell, taste. You can't touch anything. Somebody knocks you on the head, you won't feel it. You're going beyond the 5 senses into the mind. That was such a relief when you had fever for about 3 weeks, I think that was by then. Because I didn't know what it was. And I realized from that I disappeared to get to those deep meditations. So I can never ever think of it as an achievement. As I let him go, I had to disappear. If I try to achieve it, it never works. And the same with all those deep meditations I've experienced since. I haven't really experienced them. I've disappeared, and they've happened. And these were teachings, important teachings, of what nirvana really is. When you get into some deep meditations, and some of you get close, and they say, what do I do next? Two mistakes, sir. Actually, three mistakes. I, do, and next. No I. Let go. Don't hang on to the driving wheel of your meditation. Do it, you're not doing anything. Let go. Let it be. Next. There is no next. It's just this moment. Go now. Not do next. That means you get very peaceful. But it does get very scary for people. You know why it's scary? Because you have to let go of everything you thought you were. You vanish. You're gone. You're gone, baby. You're gone. But you're perfectly awake and aware, deeper inside. Now that gives you some insight what nirvana is. Things disappearing and vanishing, going. And then, once you get some of these experiences in your life, how to get very deep meditation, peace and stillness, and no problem with your body, no matter how old or sick or injured it happens to be. Once you can do stuff like that, you can understand what nirvana means. Things stopping and finishing. In the time of the Buddha, everybody would know what nirvana meant. Even little kids. Because when the oil lamp went out, the little kids, mummy, mummy, the oil lamp is nirvana. They use it as a common word in those days. You know, if the candle goes out, candle nirvana. And that was one of the great stories the Buddha gave to this monk called Agyewatchagota. Agyewatchagota was his name. Agyewatchagota was the name of the sutta. And this wanderer asked the Buddha, when a person becomes enlightened, when they achieve nirvana, where do they go? What happens to a person once they achieve nirvana? How do you think the Buddha answered? He said, look at that flame. Suppose it's a candle flame. That flame depends upon three things. The wick, the wax, and the heat. When those three things come together, wick, wax, and heat, you get a flame. Now, if any one of those three fuels, or if you like to call them causes, any one of those three causes stops, either the wax is all used up, the wick dries up, or not dries up, but gets all burnt out, or a wind blows the heat away. What happens to the flame? Where does the flame go after the candle goes out? If it's been a very good flame and kept you nice and warm, will it go to heaven where all good flames live happily ever after? If it's been a bad flame, like all those flames happening in Sydney, is it going to go to some hell realm and burn one another? Of course, that's ridiculous. When any one of those three causes is extinguished, the wax is used up, the wick is all burnt out, or I told people that that's our fire strategy in Monastery in Perth. You know there's many fires in Australia. So over in Bodhinyana Monastery where I live, I told all the monks, if there's a fire there, this is how to put it out. All stand in the line, and on the count of three, one, two, three,
You don't believe that's possible, do you? You've got no faith.
Now we've got other people, big fire hydrants and stuff.
But anyway, if it's been a very bad fire or good fire, it doesn't matter. The fire just goes out, it finishes. Because what is a flame anyway? It's just a combination of three things. That's called flame.
Who are you? When you go out, when you nirvana, you don't go anywhere. You just stop. You're finished. It's all over. I didn't mean to go whispering, but phew, what a relief. For that is the meaning of nirvana. Do you agree with that? You agree or you don't agree?
Not really mattering. But to give you another angle on it, to make it so you really understand, there were these five children playing a wishing game. Somebody told me this a long time ago, I was like, wow, this is a great simile for what nirvana is. Five children playing the wishing game, and the rules are like this. Every child has a wish, and the one who comes up with the best wish would win. So the first kid put their hand up and said, if I had a wish, I would wish for a new Nintendo computer game, whatever it is. I don't know if that makes any sense to you, because I haven't got a first clue about what computer games are. I've been a monk for 45 years, so I don't know what a computer game is, but apparently Nintendo is one of them. Is that correct? Well, okay, good. Good luck. The second kid said, had more time to think. She said, if I had a wish, I would wish for a computer game shop. If I owned the shop, I could get a new computer game whenever I wanted. That's obviously a much better wish. Uh-oh. And if I had a wish I was blind so I didn't get anyone else. Dear Ajahn Brahm, gentle reminder. 10 minutes crossed out, 5 minutes more. Took you a long time to think like that. Okay. So, we won't have time for the wishing game story, so I have to stop now until then next week. No! I knew you'd say that. So, the third kid said, if I had a wish, must be something much better than that, a computer game shop. If I had a wish, I'd wish for $100 billion US. Oh, that's a lot of money. Because with $100 billion US, that's a wish, the first thing I'd buy is my own computer game shop. So if I'm overseas, I can go somewhere else and buy my computer games. But the problem is with kids playing computer games, their mothers and fathers always tell them to do their homework first. So, after buying my own computer game shops, I would next buy my own school. If I own the school, the teachers always have to give me good marks. Otherwise, I sack them. Even the headmaster has to be nice to me, otherwise I'll never give him any holidays or any increase in his salary. And once I graduate from my own school, and I'll then buy my own university, I don't have to do any work, and that way I can play my computer games whenever I like, however long I like, without any problem. And with $100 billion US, there's anything else I ever want in my whole life, I always have plenty of money to spend. The $100 billion US wish. Can you beat that? The fourth child waited for a while.
whenever people ask you questions, never be the first or the second or the third. It was just like this story of the Catholic priest, the rabbi, and the Buddhist monk, who decided, you know, to try and get some conversations about spirituality going. And as they were trying to get this conversation going, they decided just having tea or lunch, just, you know, they didn't get close enough together. So they decided to have some games. They decided to play cards. They decided to play poker and actually bet, because that would actually engage them in real life more. So they're actually betting on poker. And somebody found out in that place it was illegal. So they all got arrested. This very, very well-known monk and Anglican Catholic priest and rabbi had to go in front of the judge. And the priest went first. Priest, you've been accused of gambling and playing poker for money. Is that true? And of course, the priest can't lie. Well, we're not supposed to. But what he did, really quickly, he looked up to heaven, Jesus forgive me, and said no. It's so fast, the magistrate didn't even see it. Secondly, so I said, okay, you can go. Then the rabbi. I don't know if you've done this in Singapore, but when I was a kid, you know, sometimes we're like, okay, yeah, when I was a kid, sometimes I did this, when somebody asked you a question and you didn't want to give the right answer, you put your hands behind the back and cross your fingers. Have you done that? So the rabbi put his hands behind his back and crossed his fingers and said, no, I wasn't gambling. Okay, go. So the third one was the monk. And by now, the judge was a bit suspicious. You don't believe, so in Jesus, they can't look up in heaven to God's forgiveness. And put your hands in front of you, monk. Now, monk, were you gambling? And the monk replied, with whom, your honor? So anyway, back to the fourth kid. More time to think. And the fourth kid was, she was a genius. She said, if I had a wish, I wish for three wishes. That's a wish. For my first wish, I'll have the computer game shops. Second wish, I'll have $100 billion US. For my third wish, I'll have three more wishes. That way, I can go on forever. Beat that. That's a really tough wish to beat. An infinity of wishes granted. The last child easily won the wishing game. The last child said, if I had a wish, I wish I was so content I never needed any wishes ever again. That's the Buddha. That's describing Nirvana. So content, you don't need wishes. Now you know what Nirvana is. Sadhu. 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 Very good. Answer some questions. Well, okay. Yeah, what have you got?
The first question is it possible to attain Nirvana in one lifetime?
Yes, next question.
Yeah. Unequal, may I know how is enlightenment related to the stages of Nibbana. Thank you.
Oh yeah, there are stages of Nibbana. This was one of the Buddha's similes, a very good simile of the shipwrecked sailors. To make it sure, one of those shipwrecked sailors was floating in the ocean. He's a good person, could actually keep his head above water. And as he was looking around, he saw dry land. We call that the first stage of enlightenment, knowing where your safety lies. And then, knowing where dry land was, he started swimming towards dry land. That's called the Vajracchana. He was so close to dry land, he could now stand up, he could feel dry land underneath his feet, but he was still in the ocean. So he's just wading to the shore. That's called the non-returner. And the last person was sitting under the mango tree on the shore, safe, relaxing to the max. That was the Arahant. That's one of the similes of the stages towards enlightenment. Once you realize what the problem is and what the solution is, of course, then you go for it. Next question, please. No. Oh, it's nice to have echoes in this room. Whoever built this, you didn't get the echoes out. But anyway, no. The Nirvana is not Nietzsche, it's not Anisha, it's not Dukkha, it's not Sukha, it's not Anatta, it's not Matta, it's nothing. So no labels stick to it. How can you write some anicca or dukkha or sukha on the air? There's nothing to write it on. Okay.
Sorry, that's not my food. AJPM. Everyone wants to go to or be in the Nirvana. No one wants to go to the hell realm and be with the ghost. Many are also fearful of ghosts. What are the best ways to eliminate or reduce the deep-rooted fear of ghosts?
Oh, poor ghosts. You don't need to be afraid of ghosts. Ghosts can be very helpful to you. They can. Many of you who have been to, say, Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat Center may have met it is one of my retreats, Bianca, who does most of the cooking and also the organizing. Her partner, when she first became a Buddhist, was a gentleman called Ron. This is a true story. The ghost is involved in here. And Ron was a very hard-working but very poor man. And he was working as a builder's laborer in an old house in Mount Lawley in Perth. And because he was the most junior employee, he was there on a Friday afternoon evening by himself. And as he was cleaning up, he heard the sound. Put your hand under here. Put your hand under here. And he looked around. There's no one there. There's no one. He thought, just imagine it. And then he heard it a third time. Put your hand under here. There was not a human being speaking that voice. But he was young, adventurous, so he put his hand underneath the house where he was told, and he felt a big tin box underneath the house. He pulled out that tin box. This was maybe, must have been about 30 years ago now, and it was full of cash, like $12,000, $13,000, $14,000 in cash. The reason why they were renovating that house was because the previous owner had died. And the previous owner never liked paying tax. So put his money underneath the house. And it died. And now it was a ghost, and before he passed on, wanted to make sure that that money was given to someone who could really make use of it. And that was Rabbi Anka's partner. And they used that for the deposit on their first house where they lived. Ghosts can be very helpful. So look, if you're walking past an old part of Singapore where they're doing some renovations, and if you hear the sound, put your hand under there. Now whatever you get, remember that I told the story, at least 10% has to go to karma. So sometimes ghosts can be quite kind and helpful. That's real ghosts. I'm not talking about the ghosts in the movies. I'm talking about real ghosts. In the UK, where, you know, obviously I was born, I mixed a few people on the trip up here. One of my best friends, the first Buddhist I ever met, became a close friend. He was also a theoretical physicist. His name was Professor Bernard Carr, Emeritus Professor of Theoretical Physics at Queen Mary College in London. A very close associate of Professor Stephen Hawking's. So close that apparently Bernard was featured on the biopic, the movie about Stephen Hawking's, and the theory of everything. And also Bernard was the president of the Psychic Research Society, where I was also a member. We would go ghost hunting, we'd search for ghosts, we'd go and try and find them when we were young. And he continued on. A close disciple of Stephen Hawking's, also the president of the Ghost Hunting Council in UK. So the truth of the matter is that ghosts can't harm you. They can make you scared, but they can never do you any harm. Interesting piece of research. Okay.
Thank you, Adam. Another question. To disappear when you're attained by another seems attractive to me, what do I do?
Well, go and get reborn again. Go and have to go to school again. Get told off by your parents again. Have to find a job again. Get old again. Get married again. How many times do you have to do this? You know that sometimes that people, you may not believe this, but because I'm interested in these sorts of phenomena, and people I trust, I know, tell me this. There was one, many people had had experience of their children in the first days of their life talking real language. And this was an event which happened in, it was in California. And a baby was born, came out of the womb, and the doctors and midwives, whoever was there, they saw it, they heard it. This kid came out of the mother's womb, just a baby, maybe an hour, she looked around and said the words, "Oh no, not again." If you understand why he would say that, you understand, well, when you've had enough, then maybe you can leave. Next question.
Yeah.
When you breathe in peace, there is no more. If you have to let go, does that pick up all the problems again? If you really do it properly, breathe in peace. If you really are peaceful, fine. But there's, you know, you haven't got enough, it takes a lot of peace to actually, you know, to fill your mind out. There's still some problems left afterwards. It's like, how much money do you need?
Sometimes marks know lottery numbers. So if I gave you a lottery number, would you be happy? But then you want the lottery number next week as well, and the week up. People actually win lotteries. As soon as they've won a lottery, they buy a lottery ticket the next week. Weird, isn't it? How many millions is enough? To me, I've got nothing. Nothing. That's why I'm happy. It's a lot of time people have a teacher, they usually don't ask for instructions, they ask for help them solve problems with their finances, to ask for lottery numbers, who they should marry, have child for their diseases. It's good to have a teacher, but sometimes how people think that their questions are so personal. You know, the first time that I became a meditation teacher and led a retreat, I gave interviews and the person came up and asked this question on meditation. I thought, well, that's really interesting. The next person who came in asked exactly the same question. And the third person who came in, here we go again. Many of your questions are not unique. You have the same questions as others. But that is why I write books. I thought, if I write a book, you don't need to ask any questions anymore. This will work. Okay, so that's another question.
The best practice
is Eightfold Path. That's the best. Not just meditation. Do the whole path. Oh, really? Only two girls, but how many people are in this room? That's disappointing. Okay. Everybody can remember their past lives, but not many people do. It can be done. But sometimes people say, no, no, one life enough to remember. That's enough suffering. I don't remember two or three or four. But it can be done. If you can't do that through meditation, you can do it through hypnosis. Hypnosis is a really interesting tool. These days more and more people know to hypnosis, to the point that there's this story of this monk who started his temple, and it was so hard to get enough donations to pay the bills. So he went to a very senior monk and asked for help. And the senior monk said, look, this is how you should do it when you first begin as a teaching monk. When you give a talk, close all the windows, make it really warm, give a boring talk, and when everyone is getting really bored and falling asleep, get out one of these old watches, backwards and forwards, and when people are about to fall asleep, so that you are now hypnotized. You will do whatever I say. At the end of this talk, when you move out, you will all put $100 Singapore notes in the donation box. No 50s, no 20s, no 10s, no 40s, just $100. You will all do that as you go out, and you won't remember I said that. And then took him out of his meditation. And when they went out, they all put $100 bills in the donation box. He really cleaned up, he made a lot of money that evening. And he
thought, I better not do this every night. If I do this every night, they'll soon find out that something's going on. So he waited until he needed a bit of cash to pay the bills. And then he did the same trick again. At least he tried. Closed all the windows, no air conditioning. Make sure it's really warm, give a very boring talk, very easy for him. And when he started this night before falling asleep, he got out the clock, he started moving it backwards and forwards, and then, oh my goodness, he got the clock. And automatically he actually swore, he said, oh shit. And it took him a couple of weeks to clean up the hall. That is called bad karma. And you got the result straight away. Mindfulness and wisdom, of course mindfulness and wisdom is important. But wisdom means you're not continuously mindful. Sometimes people fall asleep. Do you go to bed at night? When you're in bed at night, are you mindful? Of course not. It's not continuous mindfulness. When you're awake, then you're mindful. When you're asleep, where are you? That's a question I let you answer. Yeah, next one.
How do you get over anxiety?
Anxiety? Oh, I was afraid you might answer that question. Anxiety is a stupid emotion. But if you do have anxiety, especially if it's a real problem for you in life. This was that story of that girl from Adelaide. She had chronic anxiety so bad that she couldn't even get out of bed. I'll tell it quickly because there's many other questions coming up. And doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists couldn't help her. So she went to Ajahn Brao, who's her uncle, you meet. So she gave me a call. What should I do? I said, when you're anxious, when you have panic attacks, where do you feel it in your body? What do you mean? That every emotion has a corresponding physical counterpart. When you're anxious, where do you feel it? I said, well, in my chest somewhere. Not good enough. I want coordinates, millimeters from your navel, very badly. To the right or the left? Is it wide? Is it short? Is it boxed? I want detailed descriptions. Giving her something to do. So, 3 days later she called up, she gave this amazing description. When she has a panic attack, how it appears like an oval around her, above her chest, a little bit to the left, and marvellous. Now, describe how it feels. Is it all the same all over? Well, I don't really know. Give me a call in 3 days. And after 6 days she gave me a call, she gave this amazing description of the feelings in her chest when she has a panic attack, in detail. Great, you are now mindful. Now, mindfulness is not enough. Kindness is next. Now take your hand whenever you have a panic attack and massage that anxiety as it appears on your body. And she had a living boyfriend. His name was Lloyd. If you feel too weak to massage your own chest, ask your boyfriend. I think he might say yes. So the boyfriend massaged her chest. Or she did. He said, give me a call in 3 days. In 3 days' time, she called again. Did you follow the instructions? Yes. What happened? He said, well, when I was massaging, that feeling got less and less and less until the tension, the tightness in my chest disappeared. Great. And what happened to the anxiety? And that was the light bulb moment, the eureka time. She paused and said, and the anxiety went too. Marvellous. Now you know how to deal with your anxiety. Don't look at it as the emotional problem. Look at it how it appears in your body.
You can work with that with much greater ease. And once you massage the physical manifestation of anxiety away, the anxiety is gone. And she was up out of bed in a few days, back to work, or back to study rather. She was a dental student, graduating first class honours, and about 6 months after graduating, she came to see me with Lloyd for her marriage. And I gave a kiss to Lloyd and Tiffany for their marriage. Really beautiful. It worked. She said, "You saved my life. And now I'm marrying that guy. I want you to be there to bless him." And of course I did that.
Difficult decisions. That will cause me so much anxiety, you'll find me rubbing my chest.
And I come here and don't prepare anything, give a talk for an hour, a couple of hours, and sign books and do all sorts of silly stuff. You see how successful that is. Part of success is learning how to be happy with yourself. It's actually called self-love. Being kind to yourself and accepting yourself as you are, who you are. So, in order to do that, please follow what I'm doing. Put your hands out like this. And bring them in and in and in. Because as a monk, I can't do that to girls. They get the wrong idea. And these days, when I do it to boys, they also get the wrong idea. And I can get all sorts of diseases from that. But if I help myself, I never get sued, and I don't catch anything I don't already have. Wonderful, I give yourself a good hug anytime you feel a bit sad. And really get into it. Try that, instant happiness. And quite safe too. Thank you so much. Yes, okay. So the three sadhus are given with everything you've got. Don't keep anything back. 100% full commitment, power and effort. If you haven't done this before, follow other people who have. Sadhu. Sadhu. And the big one. Sadhu. Sadhu just means awesome. So it's a very good. And now we're doing the blessing. This is my blessing for you, but all for 2020. For all the people from the Buddhist Fellowship I've known for so many years. You're actually like family. And for all the people in the Buddhist Lodge, it's really great to be back here again. Of course, I came here many, many times before. So now you've got the renovation. Brilliant. Well done. And for all the people who have not members of the Buddhist Fellowship, not the Brahm Center, not Bodhinyana International, not the Buddhist Lodge, who are just coming here, welcome. Please receive this blessing now. For your happiness, for your health, your strength, and your well-being for the next year and more. Sabo Gawini Mutos.
By letting me use the hall. You're so kind. Excellent. So what do we do now?
Sure. Yes, so may everybody write nicely and good night.